Welcome back to the program. We humans have this seemingly innate desire to measure everything. Yet what are we really observing? What are we measuring? Since we can only observe a narrow slice of the world around us, most of the universe exists far beyond what we can see, hear, feel, or touch. Many years ago, George Carlin understood this, particularly with respect to time. Take a listen.
There's no present. People say, what time is it? Well, you mean now or when you ask me. There's no present. Everything is the near future or the recent past. No, welcome to the present. Welcome once again to the present. And now the all-new. No wonder we can't get anything done. There's no time, man. Very imprecise. We start out, well, you got Jiffy. How about a Jiffy? Which is quicker, a Jiffy or a Flash? I think there are two Flashes in a Jiffy myself. But we come back to this thing, moment, trying to decide, you know, what's a moment? How long? Give me a couple of moments. A couple? I don't even know how long one of them is. I wouldn't miss a moment of this. Just did. Or did she? Maybe she only missed a half a moment. Or as some guys say, half a mo. What's that? Half a mo? Well, a moment, one third of a moment is a mo. So half a mo is one sixth of a moment. Got that one figured out, didn't we? Yeah. I mean, for a moment. How about yesterday? Yesterday. And the day before yesterday. Doesn't that sound awkward? Isn't that sort of simple-minded? Yesterday? Cool, we got a name for it. The day before yesterday. Sounds like a third grade thing.
My guest today, popular science writer David Blattner, in his book Spectrums, takes us on a journey to those parts of the universe that are indeed intangible. David Blattner is internationally known for his popular science books, including The Joy of Pi and The Flying Book, and it is my pleasure to welcome him here to the program today to talk about his newest work, Spectrums, Our Mind-Boggling Universe from the Infinitesimal to Infinity. David Blattner, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Great to have you here. We do have this seemingly insatiable desire to measure everything, to compare everything, and yet we're never quite sure what it is that we're comparing it to.
Well, that's true. And you know, that Carlin bit was perfect because there's such a sense of, you know, he always had his pulse on what makes us uncomfortable, the sense of the universe that we all experience, and yet we don't really want to look too close, because if you look too close, you're going to start wondering what's really going on there. And time is a great example of that. You know, you have this, we all know what time is, and yet when you really look at it, we have no idea. We just don't know what time is about at all. And in fact, scientists are struggling with this all the time. We, you know, scientists are looking at time, and they're trying to break down time into what is it, how do we measure it, and they struggle with us day in and day out. How do you name amounts of time? How do you even compare two slices of time together? You know, time is one of those fascinating aspects of physics where, you know, everything, you could hold up two bananas next to each other, and you could say, well, this one's longer than that one, but you cannot hold up two slices of time next to each other. You can't really know if two slices of time are truly the same or different, because once it's gone, it's gone. It's slippery.
And with all of the things that you talk about, time as well as size and color and heat and light, that the real confusion becomes at the extremities of these things, as you explained it, that the further out you get on either side of the proverbial spectrum, the more confusing it is and the less we understand.
You know, in Spectrums, I try and take each spectrum, each chapter follows a different spectrum, as you mentioned, light or size, heat, time, and I look at the narrow band which we're familiar with, which we're comfortable with, and then, as you say, I push it out to the extremes, and at those extremes, everything breaks down. First, we start understanding, we stop understanding what's going on, and then it just gets so weird that it's possible that we cannot understand them. And that's what's fascinating to me about the universe. We have a sense that we should be able to know, and yet when you really look at it, the more you look at it, the more you realize we probably will never know how things really work.
And part of it is that it's defined in many ways by us humans based upon how we experience it, and those things that we can't experience, we can't really relate to in so many ways.
It's true. And, you know, a good example would just be the idea of numbers. I opened the book talking about numbers and the idea of how do we understand numbers. And each of us has an inherent feeling for numbers. It's been proven that, even babies have a basic sense of, you know, 1, 2, 3, up to about 6 or 7. There's a sense of we understand that. After that, it takes more and more understanding about the universe, more and more experience, to really start to be able to get a feel for numbers. And yet, it's possible that no human can really understand numbers beyond a few million. And this is interesting because we have to deal with numbers, very large numbers, all the time. You just look at the national debt and you start thinking, wow, these are big numbers that we have to wrap our heads around. And yet, it's very difficult for humans to understand anything beyond which we can see. There really is that sense of seeing as believing or seeing as understanding. Because we can see a million things. You could line up a million dots on a rather large poster and see them all. But there's no way that you could see a billion of anything. We are simply not set up to understand that.
Which is why we have this innate desire, I suppose, to constantly compare and to set up examples.
I think so. I think we are insatiably hungry. You know, humans are hungry and our curiosity drives us. And I think that's a wonderful thing. I think that where it gets us into trouble is when we follow the clues and start to believe that we can find an answer. This is I try and lay out in the book as many answers as I can, but I constantly come back to the point that we're ultimately not going to be able to know. You know, there's this idea of mystery, and in the 20th century, the ultimate mystery writer was Agatha Christie, right? So we have this sense that in an Agatha Christie novel, we'll be able to follow the clues of the mystery, and at the end, we'll have an answer. And I think that the 20th century, we really had an idea that that would happen. We'd be able to extrapolate that out to all of our mysteries. And yet now, in the 21st century, we're going back to an earlier definition of mystery, one where the more answers we find, the more questions follow. And that's kind of exciting as well because, you know, we just keep following more questions and finding out more and more.
This comes back to the extremities that we talked about before. The more we move towards trying to understand this physical world and some of these areas you've talked about, particularly the extremities, it runs up against the realities of physics that we think we know and understand, but there are things that seem to be outside of the realm of what we're sure of.
Absolutely. There's plenty that's outside the realm of what we're sure of, and we continue to try and figure that out, and we continue to be stymied. But what's fun is looking at what we can understand. It's fun to stretch. You know, we spend a lot of time stretching our bodies, going to the gym and so on, but it's also fun to stretch your mind, and that's a lot of what I'm trying to do in Spectrums is learn how to stretch your mind a little bit more each day so that you can start taking in more of this. Size is a good example. If you can, you know, it's quite easy for us to understand the size of our community, of our cities, perhaps even a state. But when you really start thinking about the size of a country or the world or planet, it's actually rather difficult, it turns out. You have to work at stretching. Then when you go beyond that to the size of our solar system, it's really mind-boggling. That's where it gets crazy. And then you go beyond that to the Milky Way. And so what I try and do in Spectrums is give us exercises for giving a sense of what that must be like. So, for example, our Milky Way. If you took the Milky Way galaxy and you shrunk it down to the size of a football field, how big would our solar system be? Or how big would planet Earth be? It would be smaller than a grain of salt within that entire football field. So you start to get a sense of the range. We're not just small in the Milky Way. We are almost infinitesimally small. And so going down into the size of the atom is a similar exercise.
There was a film, I don't know, 20, 30 years ago that Charles and Ray Eames did called Power of Ten that sort of dealt with these kind of ideas.
You know, I love that you mentioned that. That was one of the inspirations. As a child, I saw that movie, and I still remember this experience of watching that movie in elementary school just after it came out, and I was completely blown away because it was so clear that the vast majority of our universe is invisible to us, completely outside of our realm of everyday understanding. And that movie, The Powers of Ten, you can still find it. It's free on YouTube. The Powers of Ten really looked at size And with each second, they went to a different power of size. So they started with 1 meter and then went to 10 meters and 100 meters and 1,000 meters and so on, going back, 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 back. And then they turn around and go in. So from 1 meter down to a decameter or to a centimeter or to a millimeter, down, down, in, until they're looking at the atom and what's down at the range of the atom. And you really have a sense of size. And I took that theme of looking at the very large and the very small, and then I applied it to other spectrums in our world as well, like heat. You know, what is the very, very cold? Is there an absolute cold? Well, there is. Absolute cold, absolute zero. And then can you turn it, flip it around? What's absolute hot? Is there such a thing as absolute hot? So I go out to the other extreme, and I look at each of those spectrums from one extreme to the other, and then figure out where we are in the middle.
The absolute hot is what we're trying to find out at LHC and try and find out what the conditions were at the moment of the Big Bang.
That's very true, and that is some fascinating research going on both there and at the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva. They're trying to make it hotter and hotter, and they're finding, not only are they finding amazing phenomena that's happening, they're even finding new forms of matter at those incredible temperatures. So as you get into the, not billions, but trillions of degrees, you start breaking down atoms into their component parts, into subatomic particles. And they're talking about making these quark gluon soups, because it's actually a sense of a soup. It's kind of a soupy texture of subatomic particles. It's a fascinating world. But the absolute hot is actually far beyond that. Absolute hot, even the subatomic particles would break down into virtually nothing. And that's a fascinating world as well. That doesn't happen for a long time. In fact, the theoretical absolute hot is 140,000 million billion trillion degrees. That's about 14 with 31 zeros after it. It's a very, very big number. We're not even close to getting to that. And at that point, what's fascinating, at that point, each subatomic particle would be moving so close to the speed of light that it would drop into its own black hole, which would be bad.
But we're not there yet. So
no, we're not even close to
that. I don't
think
we have anything to worry about.
That's right.
Talk about it as it relates to sound and what we don't understand about that.
Well, sound, I love sound. We all do. We love listening to the radio, and we love hearing that sound come from a speaker into our ears. And what we don't usually think about is what's really going on there. What's really going on is that it's a game of billiards is happening. And the billiard balls are the molecules in the air. And air, we usually think of as virtually nothing, but air is full of these molecules, tiny molecules of air, oxygen, nitrogen, carbon dioxide, and they're bouncing into each other. They're moving at about 1,100 miles an hour, very, very fast, bouncing into each other, and each one bounces into one, and then that bounces into another one, and it's like having a string of billiard balls all the way from the speaker into your ear. And the molecules aren't moving themselves very far. They're just enough to bounce into the ones next to them. But the energy can move very fast through the air, through that transition from one molecule to the next. And they're moving a very small amount of space, very, very small. In fact, we can hear when a molecule moves about a tenth of its diameter. That's actually smaller than an atom moving. We can hear it, not when just one moves, because it doesn't really do anything, but when you have waves of those vibrations, of the pressure getting a little bit more compressed and a little bit less compressed, when there are regular waves, our ears amplify those waves, and then we can turn them into sound, which are electrical signals in our head that we interpret as sound. But they're moving extremely small amounts, and that's extraordinary, really.
Then, of course, there's the link between sound and light and color that we don't really see, but there is this connection.
You know, at almost every one of the talks I give, somebody comes up afterward and asks me about synesthesia. Synesthesia is an effect of the brain where oftentimes people will hear numbers or they will smell sounds and so on. And some people think that there's a disconnect in the brain. Somehow something's going wrong. I actually think that it's not that something's going wrong. I think it's that more things are going right. I think that there are these connections, and our brain intuitively understands that there are connections among all of these different spectra that we experience. And we are sensing that and trying to get more, give it almost more meaning. But specifically, there are connections between sound and light. For example, back to the radio, the radio waves that came, that arrive at the radio that we're listening to, the radio waves typically are moving through light. So it's actually sound. I'm speaking, and that sound is being transferred into an electromagnetic signal. That signal is being translated into light, a light signal. The light signal is moving through the air, and that light signal is amazing to me because light itself is one of those experiences. We have a sense that we know what light is because we flip on a light switch and we can see it. But light actually goes far beyond what we can see. So when you use a microwave, you're cooking with light. I mean, people talk about that, but think about what that literally means. There is light, and it's the same light that we can see, but it actually moves molecules. It's actually moving the fat and water molecules inside food. And that microwave, so microwaves are one example of light that we cannot see. Radio waves are another example. So when you have a giant radio transmitter on a tower, that literally is a light bulb. There's a huge light bulb on a mountain out there that is shining light at certain frequencies out into the world. And then our radios are taking that light, which we cannot see, but the radios can pick it up and convert that light back into electrical signals that go to a speaker that get converted into sound again. And that whole experience is moving extremely quickly, and yet it is it does take some time. So there's sound, there's light, and there's always time, because time gets into every piece of it.
There is also a complexity of how we understand all these things. As we understand some of the things that you're talking about, some of the ideas that you put forth in spectrums, particularly some of the things that happen on the extremities, it shapes our worldview. It shapes how we view other things that perhaps are more normal or more traditional, and literally changes how we see the world.
Well, I think every time you learn more about something, it changes your view of that thing. You know, this happened a lot. This happened to me when I was working on the flying book, this book I wrote some years ago all about the experience of flying in commercial airlines. And I'm not a pilot. I'm just a passenger. And I realized that a lot of people like myself have no idea how this works. And because we have no idea how it works, it makes us a little bit nervous. It's uncomfortable. So the more I learned about it, and to the point where I could write a book about it, the more I learned about it, not only the more comfortable I became, but the more amazing the experience became. So with each additional bit of knowledge and with each insight into the way things work, I believe that we go beyond discomfort into becoming more comfortable, and then beyond becoming more comfortable into awe and wonder about the world. And that is really where I want to draw people, into the sense of wonder about everything. Because everything you look at, everything we experience, there's so much more going on behind the scenes.
It's one of the things that science fiction, I suppose, does for us in a certain way, that it gives us the opportunity to start to think about those things.
I think so. But, you know, I love science fiction. It's fun. Some science fiction really gets into the physics of things. I'm reading a piece, Terry Pratchett's book of The Science of Discworld, where right now, and it's fun because he's exploring the idea of physics through fantasy and science fiction, but it's really looking at the physics of our universe that we're in, and it's terrific. I think that science fiction is fun, and yet at the same time, the universe truly is a case of truth is stranger than fiction, because when you read hard physics, you start wondering, you start realizing that there is just extraordinarily weird things happening in the universe. And beyond weird, we don't really know what's going on. And that can both be exciting and also a little frustrating and certainly scary when you start realizing that we don't understand, like I said, how time works. We don't really know why time moves forward, not backward. We don't really know what space is. This is one of the strangest parts about spectrums to me, is looking at size, And the size is the easiest thing for us to get a sense of spectrum on, you know, the very small to the very large. But all size depends on space. And we don't really understand space and what space is, and therefore how could we really understand what size is? And that's a tricky thing to wrap your head around, but it is, like I said, both exciting and terrifying.
All like that proverbial iceberg where three-quarters of it exists below the surface.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely.
David Blattner, his book is Spectrums, Our Mind-Boggling Universe from Infinitesimal to Infinity. David, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate it.
Here.